in December 2011, and I did have to start on the regular normal on the eve of the Civil War. And in fact, I came in to tell the story of the franchise in Indiana. Bob had a history degree from Indiana University, but spent many a year at for dinner, over 35 years with it.
Demonstrate their patriotism by forming companies and soldiers. with the Trinity in the past two generations in the past, the Indiana militia was basically defunct. There hadn't been any involvement from since 1836. Even before something was fired upon, as the 76th began to see it, informal food box companies began forming. One of these was in a tiny market town of Paul, which is northwest of Martinsville, Morgan County. The local family of Andrew Weldon was elected captain, and after Lincoln called for volunteers in late July, this company marched to Indianapolis. So we're going to tell something today for the 33rd year. The patriotic spirit, I think, of Morgan County was very typical, particularly in the county seat of Martinsville. Company K of the 90-day service in Indiana had been ready for them. And when they returned to the city after service in West Virginia, the whole town turned out to greet them. There was a banner across Main Street that said, "Welcome to the Braves." Band players, citizens lined the streets, and Chick-fil-A, as the local newspaper pointed out, moved quickly to go. The children fell forth a noisy, patriotic throng as they were set. After their return, the clamor continued. The Morgan County was a jet preached union cause in every issue. Another prominent citizen, like the county judge, A.S. Brady, the speeches encouraged men to volunteer to save the country. This atmosphere leading citizens of Morgan County, like James Martin, a prominent farmer, and a county auditor, when he became an anchor, helped organize two more companies. The 38-year-old anchor left his wife and seven children to serve the union. 181 men soon departed from the market and used to become companies to the union. Similar enthusiasm led to enlistments all across the state, across the North and the South. There was a mass meeting of farmers in Knox County, where a local judge, a man named Law, said, "If we have a government, and I think we're there, it is our duty to sustain it." John Freeland was a prominent physician and politician in the county. In fact, his hometown is called Freeland Town. He had 103 men, except for one of all farmers, volunteer and took the train to the cattle. They did it in Washington, D.C. At Smithton, which is in Shelby County, the then 24-year-old farmer, Edward McCray, organized 500 men. In a week, they would become Company B. They were the first of 3,261 men in Shelby County who will serve in the Union Army. Now, considering the whole population of Shelby County, men and women, children, old people, and everything, is under 20,000, this may well be the highest percentage of people who serve in any county in the state. Dr. Eli Whitaker is a prominent physician in Owen County. He helped raise a group there, but he was rather elderly, I think he was in his mid-50s, so he declined to serve due to his age. But he found a guy named Isaac Kendrick in Indianapolis, and was an orderly sergeant of the 11th Indiana, as another one of his own divisions, and he agreed to lead this company, which had only 72 men. Many of them coming from the Indianapolis area, and joining what eventually became Company E of the Holy Church. Young men from Princeton, in Gibson County, Indiana, quickly formed a unit in mid-July and went into camp at the county fairgrounds. It was led by James Henderson, teacher at the Bolton Academy. He would eventually become lieutenant. After, quote, receiving the attention of their friends for a week, they moved to Camp Warden in Indianapolis, which is the rendezvous of most of these locally raised units. Without guns, the men did guard duty with colors. The government was a lot of colors. After another week, they moved to Camp Sullivan, where he joined the other companies that would become the 33rd Indiana. Meanwhile, in Columbus, a man named Israel Dillon, Mexican war veteran, who was the publisher of the Columbus Democrat, was chosen captain of the company he had helped raise and publicize through the pages of his newspaper. Meanwhile, in the nearby hamlet of Poole, their feast is formless, and has gotten into business today and again. Another unit of local farmers found itself the host guard. They form with an even 100 volunteers. And these two units, they have their Harlan State Company in As these companies reported in Indianapolis, a handful of experienced current or former regular Army officers and sergeants began the rudiments of military drill. One farm boy in private wrote his father that we get 3 meals a day, before and after each meal we drill. I am tired of this. We've been in the Army 5 weeks on what turned out to be a 4-year mission. Then in September, then Governor Oliver Perry Morton commissioned John Cooper as the colonel of the regiment to be organized in San Jose and designated the 33rd Indiana Volunteer Infantry. Cooper was typical of the civil leaders who became colonels of regiments both north and south. He was the son of a Harvard educated attorney who had moved to Indianapolis, 35 years old, and an honors graduate of Walter College. He came in recruiting, served in the state legislature, and married the first cousin of teacher union general and author of Wallace. In 1859, he became a judge of the Court of Common Pleas here in Marion County. This program is strongly supported in Indiana, Indiana's Governor Morton on the election campaign of Abraham Lincoln. And so he was appointed colonel of a regiment, even though he had absolutely no military experience. Not everything. General John Webb, the commander of the camps around Indianapolis, designated the companies to form the regiment. They were stationed in Camp Sullivan, which was present at military park, carried out in Indianapolis. As we've seen, the 9 companies were originally selected. Right now there are only 9. They're all from southern Indiana, south of Indianapolis. Most of the men were farmers in small towns and rural areas, and all but 42 of them were born in the United States. As the regiment assembled, the various captains of the company got together and elected the field officers. James Henderson and Captain Gibson County Company F was named the lieutenant colonel. William Marshall of Morton County, Company C, became the major. And the units, the men in those companies then elected new captains. Remember, this was a civil war. Yes. And so it was a political war. And the officers, by and large, were selected by the soldiers. This is quite common in those times. Colonel Coburn was the only officer who was not elected in some way by the new regiment. None of these officers, and so far as we know, no one listed them. And any regular Army experience or formal military education, more than a handful have served in Mexico or on the 90-day regiments that we've been in aviation and ordnance. And this too, they were quite typical of the newly organized regiments from both sides. So on September 16, 1861, the regiment was mustered in the federal service with 43 officers and 905 while Legend was being organized, another company was being formed in the Warren County. Company D of the 10th Indiana was 1980 had been raised there, and after returning from West Virginia was reorganized for 3 years. The local historian described the scene. Schoolhouses were still a loyal assembly, expressing the fiery words from farmers. The camp. Delegations from wagons, drawn off in about 6 horses, and men on horseback and on foot, came through the dust from all parts of the town, led by stirring bands and marching music. So many men volunteered to reorganize that company. Not only was Company B recreated, but another unit under 11 Miller, the company's former lieutenant, was raised to accept any office. Providing equipment for the tens of thousands of soldiers in the assembly was a huge problem for both sides. It was 11 days after mustering that the 33rd was finally equipped. rather than punish words of Private Lee, faithfully as Morristown Cardinal. September 27th, there are uniforms for sale. Our guns this evening, they are the rightful weapons. Regiment is very fortunate. There was a tremendous demand for weapons. The Union Army got all kinds of rifles and muskets, including three boards and two philosophy generals by the Quintlock. 33rd got three brand new Springfield rifle muskets. I would have to think that Colonel Coburn and his connections to the government have something to do with that, because Governor Norton is very actively involved in making organizing the criminals. The next day we received a post, Tavistock and other accoutrements, which ripped the rifle and ammunition total from 40 pounds of equipment to carry, and that was almost a third of the weight of the average recruit. Not nearly the 33rd would have had 2 weeks or even months to grow and organize, but the war situation didn't allow any time at all. Kentucky was teetering between North and South, and President Lincoln, of course, invaded Kentucky. Was very concerned to stay the state in work. In the words of one historian, the rebels under the lead of John C. Breckinridge, Simon Buckner, and others, resolved to plunge the state into a whirlpool, especially. They held a convention, met in secret conference, organized in drill companies, and threatened another man. The news came to Brigadier General Felix Volokhov, leading the force of Tennessee and Mississippi troops from eastern Kentucky, Washington, Florida, whatever men were available in that area. Even though it had been in federal service for less than 2 weeks, and was short one company, the 33rd of the Washington Center. On the 29th of September, it loaded into train cars at Louisville and Nashville Railroad, and reached Louisville that night, where they were quartered in Boone's Tobacco Warehouse. And being west of the front shortly after organization, the 33rd, I think, illustrated the difference between the eastern and western theater experience. The soldiers of what would become the Army of the Potomac and Army of Northern Virginia, for the most part, experienced 6 to 8 months of quiet after the first war run, prolonged periods of drill and organized, accustomed themselves to military life, and hardened themselves to the dangers leading to living outside. In contrast, active operations in the West began almost immediately. In Missouri and Kentucky and along the Ohio and Mississippi rivers, activity began very soon. You look at the history by February of 1862, Wilson Creek and Fort Donelson had already been fought. And as late as Shiloh in April, many units of both sides were rushed into action with little or no pause from the organization. In contrast, in Virginia, the problems are just starting to appear. As the 33rd arrived in Louisville, many of the inexperienced soldiers were soon bringing in another one. Here's one account of what happened. The arrival of the soldiers was the signal for the introduction into camp of all sorts of vendors. Men, women, and children, offered at pots, cakes, fruits of all kinds, vigorously received the soldiers for their patronage, and were munificently rewarded. Many of the soldiers did not consider the effect of such food would have a plan, and sparingly purchased an 8 hours in office. The result was a large number of them became suddenly sick. The practice death of the regiment's time in Louisville was short after a day's rest and recovery. They had been put the prize from Lexington to Nicholasville, terminus of the railroad. It was going about 20-25 miles outside the west. The next day they started out on their first road march, and soon the weight of that 40 pounds of gear started to take hold. The men were buoyant for perhaps an hour, and their energies suddenly tended to collapse completely. Eventually, the officers fell to impress some civilian wagons to pass all that gear. The Union astronomer, Richard Robinson, had donated land to a camp about 25 miles southeast of Lexington to serve as a base for troops in the Royal Citizens of Eastern Kentucky from 23. Tired and hurt. The 33rd arrived at Camp Rick Robinson on October 3rd during Fall Island Creek and Turkey Regiment under Brigadier General George Thomas, the leader who himself was a little bit suspect because he was in Louisville, Virginia. The other units have been organized about as long as the 1st Virginia Regiment and positioned in a camp where chaotic, as half-trained officers called to organize barely trained soldiers. Being the only resident in the camp, their problems in the transportation, they had 20 static wires. You're going to have to get us to go back to the connection to the WMF. The regiment was ordered forward to a camp near Crab Orchard, which is the termination of the turnpike to the south, which is basically where the good road is coming. There they were joined by a tent company to complete the regiment, the formation raised in Warren County by the local farmer by the mill. Which 101 officers and men didn't receive uniforms, weapons, or equipment until the general was on the field. On service now for a whole 3 weeks, soldiers were still feathered in. I was simply a D company reported to them. I took skirts, mummies, and flapjacks as well. We're taking a welcome tumble. The boys think they have to go through more than any soldier ever did before. It's quite random. I think the boys will not be so thorough if it gets clear. Gavin Stormont of Company F remembered, here we drove and learned some of the duties of the soldier. Crab Orchard was in a rich farming section of Kentucky and new for soldiers. Chickens, turkeys, pigs, and all kinds of vegetables, and honey, and apples, none of those things we neglected. The weather was fine. A fine location for our camp. This kind of poetry suited us to the end. In another way, the experience of trying to cope with dredging was very typical of units north and south. There's no evidence that they ever had target practice with their rifles. In particular, the list of characteristics of the rifle rifle, which a projectile had a parabolic trajectory after about 145 yards. They trained range estimation and sight adjustment crucial. Very few Civil War regiments had systematic target tracking during the first years of the war. As a result, the accuracy of long-range rifle fire was erratic, and Captain Pat Tendon was often initiated well within the effective range of the soldiers' weapons. On October 20th, 33rd was sent forward to Camp Wildcat. It's an indication of the logistics of operating this area that the main road here was the trace of the old wilderness road which Dan Magoon had used to bring the first settlers into Kentucky to Boonesboro from Cumberland Gap in the 1770s. Leaving the Grandin Company K along with H and Camp to guard the regiment's stores, the 33rd's 25-mile march to Camp Wildcat Mountain was difficult. Dirt road, places were. There were unbridged creeks on a skimpy ferry over the wild, untamed rock castle of the village. This day, if you go down to the Daniel Boone National Forest, you can see whitewater rafting on a rock castle river. I think you have to hear what they're doing. The Camp Colonel Colburn's men joined General Schultz, the 2 Kentucky regiments. The Confederates, who were nearby, saw the new regiment's arrival. In words of a Tennessee officer, I could distinctly see the bayonets of a moving column, glistening in the light of the sun over the hill. And the sight at once suggests the scriptural quotations, as the army of Christ. The next day, on October 21st, Confederate Brigadier General Felix Volkoff was advanced to the 4 Tennessee and 1 Mississippi Regiment of infantry, supported by a force of cavalry that got back. The position in the 33rd was split. 4 companies under Lieutenant Colonel Anderson holding the flanking ridge, while BEGNI and Lieutenant Colburn's personal direction held a key round hill or not, along with about 250 Kentuckians. These 600 men met the main advance of the rebels, which was the 11th and 17th Grand Troops. The 33rd Ordnance Sergeant described the battle in this way. Then we're immediately deployed around the hill and down through the village. But before this was completed, we were fired upon. A scattering fire now took place, which lasted about an hour and a half. After about 10 minutes after the firing commenced, one of our men accompanied me by the name of McFerrin, was tied to his uniform. The shot in the left chest. I was standing about 20 feet from him, talking to Captain McRae with his captain. Walked up the hill to where we were and said, "Captain, I'm shot. I'm a dead man." The carrier was going with him, but he died within about 5 minutes. After the firing ceased, I went back to camp for ammunition. While there, the firing commenced again very brisk, and the rebels began firing their cannon. They fired a few free shots when Standard's Ohio battery came up to the camp, pitched some of the tents out of the way, got in position, and fired three shots before we could save that life. The shells whistled through the air over the hills and fell bursting away in the glory of the world with their force guns. They charged up the hill with their 30 steps of our men, with their hats on their bayonets, crying out, "We are Union! We are Union!" But our brick poured volleys and volleys. After a couple of hours firing, the Confederates began to retreat. 33rd suffered an additional man killed and 15 wounded, one of whom died, while the casualties were in Company No. One of the wounded was Captain William Hauser of Company I, who had a finger shot. He had his stump amputated at the hospital, bandaged, and returned to his father's line. Most of the officers in this engagement grabbed rifles and were essentially acting as soldiers rather than as leaders. The two Tennessee regiments that attacked in the last 45 minutes rather than in the camp. And truth of battle, Wildcat Mountain wasn't much. A year later, it would be deemed a minor skirmish. But the engagement did have some lasting impact. Bullitt-Cocker's loom was deflected. 3 months later, George Thomas was defeated in the North Springs, battle of which the other general was killed. And for the 33rd, they had, from the following period of time, seen the elephants. They've been in combat. They've been shot and shot at. They were taken in and taken casualties. They were veterans. And the hill they defended today is known as Eagle Mountain. And as a sidelight, Wildcat Mountain has to be the most unique Civil War battlefield I've ever been to. There's a partly gravel dirt road that goes about 2 miles up the side of the mountain through thick woods. You're really wondering what you're going to get to when you get to the top of the hill. And then when you do, you find that there's a nice paved parking lot, there's a roof pavilion with certain markers, there's a monument and a marker about Golden Moon and Williams Road, and a little trail over the Eagle Mountain, and you can see how difficult it was for the Confederates to come in contact here. The German started to talk about 30 yards, and I guess it's a lot further than that because the hill is very steep. The feathers were the bottom of every being close to the top. So there's something to see there, but they didn't get to the top. 2 days after the battle, Company H became rejoinder. And then it moved further south through stages to London, Kentucky, arriving there by October 30th. Here the regiment began to construct shelters for winter quarters because the weather had always turned cold and wet. However, that was not the case. London is 40 miles from Crab Orchard. Crab Orchard is 45 miles from the terminus of the railroad at Nicholsville. In bad weather, troops simply could not be supplied that far on the Sunday mountain roads. In quarter to November 12th, General Thomas ordered the troops at London back to Crab Orchard. A really great book was published last year by Professor Jeff Hess, very landed called The Civil War in the West. But he really focuses not so much on the combat as on the logistical issues that both Adams had in getting supplied shoulders to recruits in Western theater. And one of the things he talked about was operating in this environment, trying to win the Eastern Zone students. They could be one to, but they just couldn't supply the recruits themselves a couple of years later. So on November 12th, Thomas ordered the troops at London Basketball Federation. For whatever reason, the regiments at London, including the 33rd, didn't begin their march until 10 o'clock at night on the 13th. As the regiment's adjutant later told the story, shortly after a cold, dreary rain began to fall each morning, the road became almost impassable. The mountain streams were swollen in volume to and beyond their bed. The march continued through the night. Wagons became stuck in the mud. Mules actually died of sheer exhaustion. Regimental and company organization broke down throughout the division. Their men scrambled and fell by the wayside in exhaustion. As the rear guard of 33rd Indiana reached the Rock Castle River at daylight, a mass of soldiers was milling around waiting for that very act of terror. General Schoten lost control of the situation and confusion reigned. So in October, placed his company A under Captain Andrew Roman in the control of the ferry at the front of the island. By this time, the 33rd's baggage included 189 sick men, jammed in the open wagon, forced to walk with the car. On the 16th, the ordnance sergeant recorded the ground froze for the first time. The trees were white with frost the next morning. After two horrible days, Schultz Brigade arrived at Crab Orchard, only to be ordered to camp in the woods instead of the buildings and barns around there so they would not upset the local inhabitants. The march in this week-long road while the wagons united with their tents had a significant opposite consequence on soldier health. Within the next 2 months, 511 men in 33rd Indiana were in hospitals. 62 of them were shot. Company D alone lost 11 men. At this early stage in the war, medical care was very primitive, and later organizations such as the Sanitary Commission, which assisted hospitals in that direction. In addition to those who died, a number of other soldiers were eventually discharged due to disabilities. Private Gavin Stormont recalled, "Our regiment lost more men on this march than in the next 2 years." While Crab Orchard and other incidents occurred, Private Bradford Silver, the company G, was court-martialed and found guilty of robbing his comrades and ordered them out of service. The witness described it this way. His head was cleanly shaved and his back labeled a heap. The dress parade was danced on the road's march. He was marched past the regiment and without the limits of camp. He was bloodied and dead. In 4 years of service, only one other man would be drummed out of the regiment. New Year's Day of 1862 saw the 33rd Indiana in the camp of Crab Orchard, preparing for a further move back north to Lexington, Kentucky, where they would remain just a month. The regiment had been in service for 106 days. It had seen the elephant, met the enemy in combat, and lost 2 men in that division. It had also lost in dead and disabled almost 10% of its personnel due to disease and exposure. 3.5 years of combat and field service lay ahead, but like other hundreds of other regiments, north and south, the 33rd Indiana Volunteer Infantry could say they were on the way to veterans. I'd like to say a final word about Colonel John Coburn. After the war, he resumed his political career and served 4 terms as U.S. House of Representatives. As chairman of the Committee on Military Affairs, he advocated the collection and publication of the reports and correspondence of the war, which led to what today we call the official records. So all historians of the Civil War period owe a debt of gratitude to Colonel Coburn, and I noticed that the author of the newsletter
noted that his presentation story that the, I believe it was Local Bar Association, gave him when he returned from the war is now in the exhibit at the Museum. That's your story. Thank you, and I'd be glad to answer any questions. Any questions or comments? Yes.
Through the course of the war, there was a meeting then. Yes, there was a tendency on the part of the Governor's Flight Board to raise new regiments because you could make turtles, and that was,
Well, you made a couple of points for that.
Cochran, I think, talked about refuse, and I know the 47th Ohio sent recruiters back as a good way for us. Often to take over the room and have an explanation for it. Was this prominent in this year at the 33rd? These officers as recruiters?
They had a rather wide, the 33rd reenlisted. So they actually served them through probably the end of the war, and they ended up in Sherman's Army and then deputated in D.C. And they probably had almost double the total number of men in the regiment over the course of the war through three things. One was additional volunteers. The other was through draftees. And the third was a surprisingly large number of substitutes. There were over 200 substitutes. And of course, the last two categories were a fairly large number of desertions. And also, they were not necessarily all from the counties. There was beginning much writing about how the fact that you were in the army within your company with your neighbors and maybe the relatives, and that had a cohesiveness impact on when you brought in substitutes and all the different females there. So it was a much higher desertion rate. I went through a look at the roster and it was 33 in the NFL. The original 905 or so enlisted men had only 30 desertions in the entire war. Which I don't know what's comparable, but that seems to be the particularly because these companies were from southern Indiana, there was a lot of copperhead activity. Owen County, where one of the companies came from, they didn't draft out, I think. But these were the men who enlisted earlier, they were volunteers, they didn't really go on the other things and this stuff too. The 33rd Indiana had the most reenlistments of any Indiana infantry regiment with all those three regiments that they raised from the pieces. Probably because they hadn't been really heavy combat, so they hadn't had any heavy casualties. Any other questions? Yeah.
I was taking notes here, so I hope I didn't miss it if you mentioned it. But were they part of a group of soldiers that had to surrender at Thompson Station?
They were from program commander of the brigade. The 33rd was one of four regiments. They had gone to the 85th Indiana and Wisconsin Division, Michigan Regiment. In fact, if anybody wants to hear the story of that, I'm giving a talk on that very topic for the City of Newtown Roundtable tomorrow. They were, it was a very strange experience. They sent out a brigade of infantry to check out the situation in Confederate cavalry rounds. And so they ended up surrounded and had to surrender. And actually, it's really strange. They put them on trains and took them all the way to Libby Place and then they said, I don't understand. And then they started exchanging them literally within a week of the final action. And you put them on March 5th and 6th of 63, and by June they were back in Tennessee by the road. And I'm not sure why that happened. Yes.
Of the original 905, specifically how many did survive?
They lost about 400 men, rough numbers, I guess. I don't think they know. Through the whole war, both in combat and in disease, probably at least half of those were from the 30s. others. I'd say they probably close to 700 survived. They really didn't, the 33rd was in the student. 33rd was a huge joint major engagement over the Thompson Station. The Atlanta campaign of Osaka and then later that Peachtree Creek. But again, they weren't, it wasn't like Gettysburg. It wasn't like they were leaving half of the minimum government. So they had a kind of a funny political involvement. And again, that's one thing that interests me other than the interest of full disclosure and their downfall and their downfall of the administration. Is that they're kind of a typical regiment. They weren't big heroes in some of their battles, but there were a lot of units like them. They served in a number of different things and had some good days and had some bad days, but certainly full disclosure. Yeah.
Could you describe a little bit more of what happened at Peachtree Creek?
At Peachtree Creek?
Yeah.
The Confederate, Peachtree Creek was where Hood's army attacked Sherman.
Yeah.
And Colburn's brigade, and by the way, Colonel Colburn was state in command of the brigade himself, the man himself. They actually engaged with Fredericksburg, Mississippi Brigade. And I happen to have a letter that my great-grandfather wrote describing this, where they were behind some barricades, and they saw the Confederates coming in, but condemned, and almost kind of like it was the soldiers and not the officers said, we want to meet them in the open. And so they actually jumped over the barricade, came out, and left it in the middle of the field and was very close to them, standing on fire, and were both. And there's a marker today in a park, and most of the Atlanta battlefields are overrun by Atlanta. But in Peachtree Creek, there happens to be actually a city park that you can mark it.
There's a golf course.
There's a golf course, yeah. That's it. On the north side of the park.
Yeah.
I went to one other place where they, one of the other locations here, golf in Atlanta. And it is now the kind of neighborhood where the houses have golf cart garages. I don't think it looked like that. Yeah.
And they had presents going down through their front yard.
Yes. Well, they were there. This is pretty high in upscale. That's over Colt's Farm, which is south of Pennsylvania. But Peachtree Creek is one of the few parts of the Atlanta battlefield that still has something like that looked like it. Yes, Bob.
During the initial organization,
that is a good question. It's the state there. And that was one of the things that governed board. It's a long story. I've been spent time on it. I actually went to the New York Bank of Baltimore in order to do that. I got more trouble. And then when the companies were organized, the regiments were organized, then the federal government would come in and muster them into service. And at that point in time, the federal government took over the responsibility for arming them and equipping them and paying them as long as they were in service. And theoretically, eventually, they reimbursed the state for that, but they weren't real good accounts, so sometimes it took quite a while. And that's one reason why Morton gets a lot of credit, because he very actively, very aggressively pushed organizing the team. Any other questions?
Bob, thank you for